Hello, dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast. Brendan, stop it. How are you doing that? German Expressionism. The massacre. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. I give this one a solid 7.4. That was Flight Through Entirety. Bang! Beryl Reed, Jenny Laird, Cilla Black, TARDIS. Shamble, bobble, dibble, dooble. Oh, Nathan, you're the funny one. Yes, I am. Thank you.
No, forget this. I'm out. No, done. You had to write that, didn't you?
I'm Nathan.
I'm James.
I'm Brendan.
I'm Josh.
Well, Catherine Tate's got the week off, and the sunlight here is poisonous, so we've decided to take a tour on a big space truck with a bunch of Daily Mail readers across a diamond planet called Midnight. What could possibly go wrong?
Do it again!
Josh, you haven't been here for our discussion of Series 4. What's your feeling about it generally?
Series 4 is my secret favourite. I think it's when everything really goes right and Russell's hitting his stride. But yeah, it's definitely one of my favourites. When I think about all my favourite new series episodes, they're usually in Series 4.
And how about Midnight itself? How do you feel about that?
Midnight is my second favourite after Turn Left, which chronologically hasn't happened yet. That's next week. But basically, Doctor Who has no money, but they managed to make it work. That's kind of what this episode is. It feels like, oh, we've run out of money for the budget for the season, so we may as well just put nothing into this episode and see what works. It's the opposite of Time Flight. Do you know what I mean? Like Time Flight, they have no money and it's a mess. Whereas this one, they have no money for it, but they took that as an advantage, if that makes sense.
It's one of those things about having Russell as a showrunner, because he's so incredibly good at making television and he knows what works. And so what he's decided to do here is basically a play on one set, and he relies on the actors to do all the special effects. I mean, it really is. It's an episode maybe more than, you know, most Doctor Who episodes that gets what you can do in 42 minutes. It's really nearly perfect, I think.
Oh, I tend to agree. I think this is one of my favourite Doctor Who stories of all time.
Yes, absolutely. It was funny, before I came down here, Rod said to me, "What episode are you doing?" And I said, "Midnight." He said, "Oh, that's so good. It's really annoying." but he's like, "I can see it's good, but I never want to watch it again."
Oh, it's so anxiety provoking, isn't it?
Yeah.
I rewatched it last night in preparation for the podcast for once. Yeah. And oh my God, I was just sitting on the edge of my seat going, even though I've watched it a million times before, I couldn't turn away from the screen. I was trying to write notes for today. I just couldn't turn away.
Yeah, I felt the same because I was trying to write notes as well. And then every time I just got distracted by just the drama of it, it's just so well written. And every moment you're kind of on the edge of your seat. Yeah.
Yeah, it reminds me so much of Rope, the film by Hitchcock, because it's got that real-time element, but also the time is compressed. It's kind of like whenever the doctor gives a time call for how much longer they have left on the bus, not that much time has actually elapsed, but they're accelerating towards the ending.
I think initially it's an hour before they're going to be rescued, and then a few minutes later it's 50 minutes. Mm. But it is still like an incredibly short amount of time. It's not the usual Doctor Who thing where things go for a day or we sleep for a night or, you know, something takes a long while to happen. It is just a very, very few hours. And so it's got a sort of real dramatic unity to it.
Scene 9, which is the bulk of the episode, ran for 44 pages.
Wow.
And so for recording, they split it up into 9A, 9B, etc., right through to 9K. And unusually for modern television, they actually had a full day's rehearsal, just the actors in a hall, old school style, because Alice Troughton, the director, and Russell T Davies went, because this is such an intimate setting, we actually want these actors to get to know each other a bit.
That's the thing that hits you in this episode, is that the characters have got to know each other. Before the midnight creature gets into the bus, you know, there's that kind of montage of them, you know, becoming friendly after the doctor's, like, destroyed the entertainment system. They have to talk to each other. They bond. And then it, when it starts to turn, it's just so shocking because you've got to know these characters in the last sort of 10, 15 minutes. And, well, it's probably actually less than that. And when they start to turn on each other and then they turn on her and then they turn on the doctor, it's just gut-wrenching.
Do you think, though, I actually think that there's a good reason to believe that the characters are a problem even before things start to go wrong. And let's talk about the characters, because there's only a small number of them and they're really well drawn. This is a Russell script, and so he's able to really kind of create characters with just a few lines of dialogue. You know, initially I'm a little bit irritated by David Tennant destroying the horrible entertainment system, because, I mean, it is horrible and it's a joke, but it's a sort of boomerish, you know, everyone's got their head stuck in their phones, you know, it, shouldn't we just talk to one another? And, you know, no one wants to do that, you know. And the interesting thing is the Doctor's faith in humanity is what makes him think that talking to one another is going to be the right thing to do. And it kind of looks like it's working, but we've already seen, you know, there's a little bit of sort of tension between Jethro and Mr. and Mrs. Kane, you know, about who's paying for it. Jethro doesn't want to sit next to them. They're kind of disappointed when the entertainment system goes down. Everyone is getting ready to spend the trip in their own world. You know, Professor Hobbs and Dee Dee are going to have earplugs in. You know, they're all being given individual juice boxes and stuff like that. The whole thing is set up for them to travel without interacting with one another. And then in that bit where the Doctor goes from person to person, you know, I think their flaws start to be revealed a bit.
The big flaw that I think is sort of writ large at the beginning is where Professor Hobbs is just nattering away and Dee Dee says, "Earplugs, please."
That's so great.
I really don't want to listen to him talk about the miners on Peladon. Thank you.
When he was dressing in royal drag.
That's right. Of course, this is David Troughton, yeah. Television's David Troughton.
I'm not even a real princess. Don't worry, I am, dear.
I was thinking, though, like, it's not just the human characters whose you see their flaws. You also see the Doctor's egotism is his biggest flaw.
Absolutely.
Mm. And I think that every single character, you got to see the worst of them. And I really like that part of it.
Yeah, yeah. Even the kind of arrogance of him deciding to just sort of take over the bus, make everyone talk to one another, and then sort of, you know, go round from person to person. That scene where Biff and Val are telling that really, really terrible anecdote about the abstract pool, and they're laughing uproariously at things that aren't funny, and clearly Val has heard it hundreds and hundreds of times before. Jethro's rolling his eyes. Like, it's so sort of fat chinos dad jokey, you know, it's appalling. Like, you're primed to kind of dislike those people, and it turns out the reason that you dislike them is exactly, you know, the character that they end up showing.
The thing is, that anecdote actually really makes me like them, because he's not laughing at how silly the idea of an abstract pool is. He's laughing at himself that he actually thought the pool was real.
Yeah, I think the Shamboni stuff's a bit racist, Brendan, actually.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, with the lobes. Yeah. Mind you, you know, we have just had Tennant being incredibly racist to Banna Cafalata.
Yeah, that's true.
Banana coffee latte, yes. Oh, God, now I'm doing it.
I was madly in love with Jethro when I watched it on first broadcast because, how old I've been? Maybe like 16, maybe 17. And I loved my 2008 emo boy. That was definitely my dream man.
And he becomes huge, of course. He'll go on to be Merlin kind very, very soon after this. And he is really great. And there's a sense, too, in which the narrative sympathizes with him a lot. Like, the Doctor looks to him. You know, there's a sense in which the Doctor and his parents are fighting over him to see who they approve of. And the Doctor's genuinely disappointed when Jethro kind of loses his bottle and joins in with them.
Yeah, it strikes me that the only people the Doctor is really disappointed in are Jethro, of course.
And Dee Dee.
And Dee Dee.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's disappointed that he can't win the children over.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing, you know, things have gone south when the Doctor can't appeal to children.
Yeah.
It seems to be what that is saying to me anyway. You know, he doesn't really expect to appeal to the adults and he's really belittling of them and whatnot. But he's never really belittling towards Dee Dee and Jethro. Like, even when he's saying, okay, Jethro, shut up, it's more, no, Jethro not helping, rather than Jethro, you stupid idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the one character that we haven't mentioned is Guy Silvestri, who is played by Leslie Sharp, who Russell had worked with before because she plays Judith in The Second Coming. And so The Second Coming, she's the kind of female lead in The Second Coming. And The Second Coming is, you know, the story of her kind of dealing with the arrival of the second coming of Christ in the form of Christopher Eccleston. And she plays a massive role. She's the kind of main character, the person who actually ends up being the one telling the story. And she's clearly an incredible actor. And so he's been waiting, I think, to give her something as amazing as this. Skye's an outsider sort of straight away, isn't she?
But she's a lesbian.
Well, yeah. So she's queer.
Yeah.
She's a lesbian, but she's also isolated, you know, and there's a kind of heterosexuality to the other two pairings of people. Mm. You know, you've got Dee Dee and Professor Hobbs. We don't think they're on together, but it is a man and a woman in a sort of subordinate position. And then you've got the middle class family on the other side, and she's on her own. And when the Doctor talks to her, the others aren't kind of involved in that. And she gets to explain that she is now on her own, like her wife has left her and moved to a distant galaxy.
I love that scene.
Yeah.
Because it's not, you know how for a long time queer characters in fiction are written either as comic relief or noble suffering AIDS victims.
Yeah.
Not lesbian characters so much. But that's the only paradigm you could have. And even in the late 2000s, that's still quite a prevalent thing. Look at most queer representation in television, apart from things written by Russell T. Davis.
Yeah.
And it's usually comic relief or somebody who's deeply sort of damaged by a horrible thing that's happened to them. It's kind of refreshing to have her just be a normal person whose marriage has broken down.
But I do think the reason that he makes her a lesbian isn't just for representation. It is also to kind of put her on the outside.
Yeah, to other her.
Yeah. So when the other characters gang up on her, do you know what I mean?
It has an added dimension.
Yeah, exactly. And plus, I love that line about it being both beef and chicken. That's so fantastic.
Beef or cow? Beef or cow? Sorry.
There's a lovely little bonding moment between them when he destroys the sound system, because she looks over and she notices the sonic screwdriver and notices everything switch off. And then she just looks at him and smiles and gets back to her book. And she's got like a proper dead tree book.
Yeah.
Whereas everyone else is going to, you know, watch Betty Boop and things like that.
That's not believable. Books are dead already now. And this is thousands of years in the past.
Dead media, like Blu-ray. I'm literally looking at Nathan's Doctor Who The Collection Blu-ray box sets on the shelf. Well, they're pretty except for the three Australian ones with the giant ratings of those.
Yeah. I haven't opened them.
No.
I'm sure they're great.
Your box is pristine. And so your Blu-ray collections.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So when they turn on the Doctor, Val says, what, like an immigrant?
Oof.
You know, he says, oh, I'm just a traveller. And she says, what, like an immigrant?
let's, before we get on to what happens when the whole thing breaks down and the characters are at each other's throats, let's talk a little bit about the monster and the way that the monster's presented.
Like, I think that the monster is so smart because, like, your first rule of, like, you watch a lot of Doctor Who episodes and everyone laughs at the cheap monster, and this was where they're never going to show it. So there was, you cut out that believability, the unbelievable factor of it. Whereas, like, I feel like Midnight's one of those episodes you could sit down with your family and you're not going to be embarrassed by it.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. It. I mean, because its ambitions kind of aren't, it doesn't sort of strive to wow you with the special effects sequences. I think it does have some nice special effects sequences, which look a bit dated now, but basically what it's doing is, you know, music, acting, script, actors.
It's an audio play.
Yeah.
So it's psychological suspense thriller audio play with visuals.
Yeah, and so the banging on the outside is genuinely properly terrifying, and it's made that, I think, because the rules of Midnight have been established, you know, that it's not just that there's no air out there, it's that the sunlight is deadly, and so nothing can possibly be outside. And so Professor Hobbs's role for the whole sort of first part of it is to reinforce those rules so that we know, because it's a made-up world, you know, the rules could be anything, but because you've got a professor in a cardigan telling you what the rules are.
so when they're broken.
Yeah, that's right. And he continues to believe that there's nothing outside, even once the monster rips the cabin off the bus. He's still protesting that this can't possibly be happening. There can't possibly be anything outside.
Yeah. I was watching this thinking, in sort of Troughton terms, he's the intransigent base commander.
He's the intransigent bus commander.
Oh.
I couldn't help myself. I'm so sorry.
That was fair. That was worth the pain.
I'm not sorry.
But yeah, he's like the guy in the wheel in space saying, I don't like mysteries, so nothing strange is happening, yeah. Gemma. Yeah. You know, that's his role. And kind of Dee Dee is the voice of reason, kind of saying, okay, it's impossible, but it is happening. So let's actually talk about what's in front of us rather than just going, oh no, that can't possibly happen.
So there is that thing too where, and I think this is Sandifer who says this, that in a Troughton kind of Base Under Siege story, people's characters really consist in how competent they are and what they think of the external threat. And the reason that this is better than those Base Under Siege stories is that the characters are more interesting and that we have something to say about about human nature. This has a really, really ambitious message, I think, this story. And we will get to it when we talk about the way that they turn on each other a little bit later.
It's a bit like Brexit, really.
Everything's like Brexit.
What, don't I get a vote, says Jethro. age 17.
No, you don't. And that's why you're going to be in poverty for the rest of your life.
I mean, something I found just visually interesting. Now, obviously, for production reasons, the space bus isn't full, you know, because we can't have that many characters unless you're Orphan 55. But it's kind of like this is one of the leisure planets, but there's no one else at the pool with Donna. There's only, what, 3, 5, 6, 7 passengers aboard this space bus that I think has seats for about 15, 16?
Yeah.
You know, so there's already the impression that this is, even for the fantastic far-off future with 15-plate glass and X-tonic sunlight, this is a slightly run-down holiday camp.
Yeah.
And I like that because that's a very British traditional thing as well, you know.
It's the macro terror.
But yes, it's we're all happy here, everything's fine here, you know, we're just going to sit here and we're going to watch our cartoons or we're going to laze by the pool. Nothing bad happens on this planet where, oh, by the way, if a window breaks, you're going to be turned to dust in 6 seconds.
The windows are 15 metres thick, though.
Well, just get Peter Capaldi to punch it a load of times.
So what happens? We see a movement. So the bus stops. and we meet Claude and Driver Joe.
Claude.
Oh, he's very sweet.
Yeah.
He is very sweet. I did like him at the time.
Joe's very pretty in his own way as well.
Yeah, well, yeah, we all are. But
even you did.
And so we just see something move outside. It's heading towards the bus. It seems to be going outside, sort of knocking on all of the kind of bus surfaces.
You know what it reminds me of?
What?
The Twilight Zone.
Oh, a terror at 50,000 feet. Yes.
Like the thing kind of pulling on the outside of the bus. Mm. And it is able to kind of rip the front off. So, and there's talk later that it's not, it doesn't have a body or something like that. Like it's so brilliantly ill-defined. And it really just does what the story needs it to do. So we talked about the Weeping Angels and I said they do what they do so that the story Blink works. Here, the monster has to be a mystery because it doesn't really work in any kind of sort of proper sense of, you know, writing a TARDIS Wikia entry on its various abilities or something. But it is amazingly, amazingly effective.
Imagine the top trumps for that monster.
I mean, I just wanted the action figure pack of, you know, Listen Creature, Midnight Monster and Crophaeus.
Wow, that would be cheap to produce.
Refusians.
The thing is, like, what does it do when it's not doing the plot? Yeah. Like, what's its everyday life?
It gets up, goes to the shops, you know. Got a,
it's chips, a member of the, goes to bed.
Yeah, yeah. It's a member of the tennis club. That sort of thing. Like, that's exactly it. It doesn't exist outside the confines of the story.
If the ball is your soul.
In a way, that ill-definedness is what makes it so scary. It's like Freddy Krueger. There's no rules to Freddy Krueger except the one rule they have to come up with to end each movie, but not in such a way that he is permanently destroyed.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like at the end of this story, the Doctor speculates that whatever it is still out there because, of course, the Sky's body may be destroyed when it goes outside, but that doesn't mean the creature is destroyed. And so the Doctor's like, I'm going to get this whole thing taken off this planet. But I do wonder with that ending, it's like, you couldn't convince five people in a bus that you knew what you were talking about. Do you really think you're going to basically convince the mayor from Jaws to take this place off? You know, and we've seen it in Orphan 55, and I pay out on Orphan 55, but one concept I think it gets brilliantly is that this is an incredibly dangerous place, but that means it's cheap and you can run a holiday business here. So why would you move unless you were being devoured alive?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, by the remnants of humanity.
But in a sense, though, you know, one of the powers, one of the Doctor's superpowers is his knowledge of aliens, you know, like he'll very frequently, even in a story where we're meeting someone for the first time, the Doctor will know who they are. Here, that's taken away from him. He has no idea, no more idea of what's going on than anyone else.
Mm. It's like you were saying earlier, Josh, with his arrogance, usually that is tempered by the companion. There's that big bit where he just basically says, you lot need me. And you can just hear in the back of your head, Donna then stepping forward and saying, he's right. He saved my life so many times. Why don't you listen to him?
Yeah, or taking him down a peg and making him look like an idiot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
possibility
like,
as well.
Yeah. Okay. Scaring people now, Time Lord.
But there's that moment where like, he's like, oh, what makes you, you know, like you're the boss of all of us basically. And he goes, because I'm clever. And he goes, oh, I've gone too far.
Yes.
And there's that look on his face like, oh, I've lost them. They're going to turn. They're turning on me and I've just gone too far.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is he hasn't proved that he's clever because he doesn't understand what's going on as well. He's as clueless as everyone else. So he can say he's clever and his egotism can do that, but you need to prove it.
Yeah. And that whole outsider thing, he and Sky Silvestri are the only two people on the bus without anyone to vouch for them. You know, the family can vouch for each other. The professor greatly underestimates Dee Dee, but in a way that is like her validation to the others because the Kane parents, you know, would obviously look down on Dee Dee because of her age and defer to the professor because he's older and he's the expert. I think it's actually Biff who says, let's listen to the professor. He's the expert. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's an appeal to authority rather than an appeal to reason.
And in fact, the outsider status of the Doctor and Sky are used against them because the Kanes accuse them of
conspiring,
you know. And so the thing about this scene where they start tearing one another apart and the Doctor is kind of yelling at them, the particular human evil here isn't just fear, but a particular type of reaction to fear. And I think it's embodied in the Kanes. I think they're the worst people on the bus. I mean, so you've got Mrs. Kane talking about immigrants, you've got Mr. Kane, you've got Biff, very sensitive to being called a coward and wanting to do violence in order to prove his masculinity, right? Mm-hmm. All of the stuff about, you know, when the Doctor turns to them and says, could you murder someone? Could you push Sky off the bus? He says that he could because he sees that as a challenge to his masculinity. The Doctor's saying, could you be so lacking in compassion? Could you bring yourself to murder someone? And he goes, yes, you know, I'm a man. I could do that.
With like Jethro, because he was younger and he was a bit more sensitive, he was really reluctant to be violent. And everyone kind of convinced him to do so because he was like, well, this is what society says you have to be masculine and stuff. That's how I interpret it as well.
No, he's definitely pressured into it. And they're his parents, you know, that's his dad. And they're definitely both pressuring him into behaving that way. And the Doctor's disappointment in him is because he's given into that, you know, like he kind of knows better or doesn't want to do that. He's better than that, as the Doctor would say. But he gives in. Yeah. Under the strain.
And as you were saying earlier, Josh, he's got that sort of goth aesthetic. And this is the first time I've noticed he actually has his fingernails painted.
Yeah.
Which
Eyeliner and stuff.
Eyeliner. And even more so in 2008, that marks him out as not a stereotypical aspect of masculinity. Yeah. And when Skye's behavior changes throughout the possession process, he is the first to notice. He notices Skye sitting at the end by herself, and then he notices that she is now synchronized, and then he notices that she has stopped repeating everyone else except the Doctor. He is, you're right, Josh, entirely sensitive, not only to others, but to the situation, and incredibly perceptive. So in a way, Dee Dee kind of has the smarts and the knowledge. She knows about the engines, she knows about the ship, she knows about myths and legends, about goblins, whereas Jethro is the more sensitive, empathic person.
And feeling, and he's coded, because he's kind of femme and goth, he's coded as other.
Yeah.
Even if it's, you know, unlike Skye's character, he's not coded as queer, he's not coded as straight.
Well, I mean, he's very quickly put into sort of conflict with his father. You know, he won't sit with them, but, you know, he's quite happy for them to pay for his ticket, Biff says. You know, like he's taking that sort of masculine provider role. And what about Val? Like, maybe out of Biff, like, Biff is violent and, you know, trying to be masculine. Val is really, really quite horrible, I think. And she's the one who actually says that she saw the thing pass from Sky to the Doctor. And she repeats that several times and bullies Jethro into admitting it as well. And at the end, when the situation's resolved, she says that she knew all along.
She's a coward.
But she will see what she needs to see in order to perform the violence that she wants performed.
Val wants to see a manager, basically.
She should have been called Karen.
Val is short for Karen.
Let's talk about maybe the most impressive thing in the episode, and that is the interplay between David Tennant and Leslie Sharp.
It is just stunning. And this episode won several BAFTAs, script writing, but also for sound and editing.
Right.
And this time around was the first time I've watched it with headphones. And as the camera moves around the room, the sound mix between Leslie Dunlop and whoever she's copying changes.
It's so amazingly good. Mm. It is so incredible.
But the thing is, sometimes the camera will be next to, like, the hostess, but you'll get Sky's audio in full.
Yes, I
and
noticed
it's deliberate.
That.
It's deliberately offsetting and off-putting. One of Doctor Who's great triumphs is doing horror without doing blood and gore.
Yeah.
And this does that so well. Like, I was watching this in a perfectly well-lit room in the middle of the day, and I had shivers up my spine.
So before she starts saying the things at the same time as them, the thing that she's doing is the thing that your younger brother does to really irritate you, that kind of repeating thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clearly designed by Russell to be something that you can do in the playground.
Yeah. Do you all know how Russell pitched this episode to Phil Collinson?
No.
Well, Russell pretty much said to Phil Collinson, ask me a question. And Phil said, what did you have for lunch today? And Russell said, what did you have for lunch today?
Bastard.
What are you doing? What are you doing? Oh. Thing is, right, so Phil gets it within three statements. Russell kept going for 10 minutes before Phil finally said, okay, I get it. This is terrifying.
So, you know, it took him 3 days to write the script.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a replacement for a script by Tom McRae called Century House, which was set on a reality TV, like, haunted house show, like Most Haunted. And they had to drop it because it was too close to Unicorn and the Wasp. And he had to write the script in 3 days. You know what the other inspirations were, though?
No.
When he was writing this? Jeepers Creepers 2.
Oh, yeah. Actually, have seen it. It is good. It's about a bus that gets stuck and is preyed upon by
exactly.
a monster.
And the other inspiration, which Nathan will love, is Darmok.
Oh, yes. I think I had heard that.
Yeah.
Star Trek The Next Generation episode.
But literally only the Radio Times listing. Which I don't have to hand, is something along the lines of the Enterprise must make first contact with an alien race whose language is unintelligible. And that was all Russell had to go on. He's like, I don't want to watch the episode. I don't want to be influenced. But this is where Russell takes that idea.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Star Trek writers take it into the idea of, oh, you know, they team up and kill a monster and there's peaceful contact between these two races. Russell's like, I'm going to tear apart a family and destroy an academic. Yeah, and you're going to like
I
it.
I love Darmok.
No, it's superb. It's great. Yeah.
That actually, you know what? I said earlier, this episode annoys Rod. When we rewatched Star Trek The Next Generation on Blu-ray, he refused to watch Darmok.
Wow.
He's like, I will never watch that again. I said, you watch the one which is the really racist planet of the black people, and you won't watch this?
Code of Honor.
Code of Honor. He said, I can laugh at Code of Honor. But yeah, it's like, well, I'm a language geek, so I'm watching it. He said, you're watching it on your own. Yeah, but it's just fascinating how two different writers can take the same idea, and especially Russell, who has that incredible side of darkness that we've seen in Queer as Folk and Doctor Who and Cucumber and Years, and, you know, writes about the optimism of the future of humanity in Doctor Who, not unfettered optimism, but optimism nonetheless, and gives us a story where basically there is no optimism for humanity.
Do you think, like, I wonder whether it's because he's writing it in 3 days and so it's unfiltered Russell, because Russell, despite, we've said this before, but despite his big, giant, jolly performance where everything's marvellous and wonderful, like we saw him on all those Doctor Who confidentials, when you read The Writer's Tale, for instance, you can see that there's a real kind of bleak cynicism to his worldview.
Yeah, he's bleak as F.
Yeah.
Bleak as folk.
Oh, bleak as folk? Very well done, Brendan.
When are we? That's our Queer as Folk podcast title. Bleak as folk.
Just not so bleak as folk.
I mean, honestly, listener, if you decide to do a Queer as Folk podcast, totally take that title. We are never going to get to it.
And then we'll sue you.
So that's absolutely here. The human race is kind of horrible. We're xenophobic. We defer to authority. There's all sorts of, you know, horrible issues with sort of toxic performative masculinity. We're easily frightened. We lash out when we're frightened. We form coalitions. All of those things that these people do.
It's basically 2016. It's quite prescient.
But it's now. I mean, but it was then, you know.
Yeah. No, but it's... He is bleak, isn't he? And it's basically him going, humanity is a trash fire. Humanity is a trash fire.
But there isn't even a moment of redemption. So one of my favorite scenes in the whole thing is where they've been through all of this and now they're stuck in the bus for the rest of the hour and they've got nothing to say to one another. And Val does her little sort of self-justification thing and the doctor doesn't even dignify it with a response.
Well, I was thinking about this story as well. Like, it could have been set in the 1800s on a train and it still would have been as relevant as it is in the far future because humanity is always the same. And I really love that.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's what it aspires to do. It does aspire to talk about humanity, not in a particular context, but generally what we're like.
It's very interesting then that the final scene where the Doctor and Donna are talking, you know, if this was, say, a Pertwee story, you would expect at the end for the Brigadier to say, oh, you know, well, the monster almost got you, Doctor, and the Doctor say, well, no, actually, Brigadier, it was humanity that almost got me, you know. But they leave that hanging for the audience to think about rather than tell us what we should think of that situation. It's quite obvious what Russell wants to present to us, but it's just like the situation on the bus itself. It's messy and kind of left as, okay, I've put this thing in the room, in the middle of the room. This is a piece of art. You react to it how you like. I'm not going to tell you what to think of this. And, you know, really, I think Chris Chibnall or even Stephen Moffat would have had that last scene with the Doctor and Donna and the Doctor railing against humanity and how could they have done this? That was a new creature, etc., etc. But instead, it's more personal and it's Donna expressing concern for what has happened to the Doctor.
I also think, too, that it riffs on a joke that's been done three times by this point in Doctor Who, including in The Infinite Quest, where the companion does an accent and the Doctor goes, no, don't do that. Mm. I mean, we had that joke a few weeks ago also in Unicorn and the Wasp. And so here when Donna says molto bene, he does the no, don't do that. And it's because we said before he's not equipped with any knowledge. So that's one superpower out of the way. But the other thing is that his speech not only doesn't work but gets taken away from him.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, the Doctor's main weapon is words. You know, all Doctor Who showrunners are like, the Doctor doesn't pick up a gun, he doesn't fire a bazooka at people, he doesn't open a cannon at people. His weapon is words. And the words are taken from him. First of all, they're taken from him because they have no power over these people who've never met him before.
Yeah.
And there's no human with him to justify him. And then they're taken quite literally.
So I think maybe for a Doctor Who fan watching the show, one of the most terrifying scenes is that incredibly directed scene where Skye Silvestri is standing up. She's in the middle of the shot. Her head is held high and she's just playing those people, you know, terrifying them about the monster that she says inhabits David Tennant's body. And he's just dragged along, fully conscious, but unable to speak. Like, that seems to be the thing. He's not controlled or possessed or anything by her. He's just being made to repeat all of that sort of Daily Mail fear-mongering that Skye Silvestri is saying.
She's paralyzed him. He's paralyzed because, like, that's the whole thing. He can't move. So he's powerless and has no voice either. So, like, he's completely robbed of any agency. And then, yeah, like, you can believe that this character is about to die. Like, he's not. It's Doctor Who. Of course he's not going to die, unless it's a season finale and he's about to regenerate. But you can totally believe, if you had never watched the show before, if you had no idea about the main character, you could believe that this, as a horror movie, that he is going to die and that's going to be the end of it.
Mm. He's not the one who gets them out of it.
No, no, it's kind of a throwback to Christopher Eccleston, where Christopher Eccleston would often inspire someone else who takes action.
But
and
does he even do that?
Well, in a way, no. It's Dee Dee.
Mm. Like, it's Dee Dee's observed what's happening, and the hostess, you know, is convinced by that. And so it is Dee Dee who fixes the problem. You know, Driver Joe's already called for rescue. There's no doubt that they'll be rescued. So it's the hostess and Dee Dee that actually solve the problem, and the doctor doesn't do anything. And they're clearly going to survive. And the only danger really is that they'll start killing one another. And the doctor looks like he's going to be the next victim.
Like, I feel like it's a lot to say. Like, even with the final line being like, the hostess, what's her name? That says a lot. And it says a lot about like, the whole thing is about like bigotry in every single way, classism, racism, the whole thing. And I think with the hostess saving the day and no one knowing her name said everything about humanity in that single moment.
Yeah. Remember, too, that the Canes are constantly telling her that her job is to fix this. So in the context of that fight, that's just them putting her down and pulling rank on her. We're the customer. But it turns out it is her job to fix it.
But also Sky says that to her as well.
Yeah.
It's your job to fix this. So it's kind of poetic that at the end of the story, it's that character, the character that's being treated like a piece of crap for the entire episode, belittled, ignored, talked down to, she's the one that saves the day. She actually does her job.
Yeah, by rising up and killing a customer.
Don't we all just want to...
We've all worked in retail, haven't we?
The extraordinary thing I find about that scene is I was just looking at the staging of it, and when the creature overtakes the doctor, it then asks the professor to help me up. And, you know, at the time, of course, I thought, oh, that's just, you know, garnering sympathy. Oh, look at me. I'm poor. I'm so helpless. You know, come and help me, please. But then I noticed that when she gets into the middle of everyone, she hardly moves. She just talks. And I thought, oh, my God, she's gotten used to the speech. Now she's getting used to the body.
Right.
And her first independent movement is when the doctor's about to be thrown out and she turns to face him and starts shouting, molto bene. And the great thing is you then cut to the doctor, molto bene, allons-y.
And in fact, it's that. There's that wonderful thing where he's trying to be jolly to the hostess and she is ignoring him. Like, she isn't interested in any of his French. So when he tells her what allons-y means, you know, she's absolutely not interested. She says something sort of hilariously dismissive. But it's her knowledge that that's the sort of thing that he would say that makes it clear to her that Sky has stolen his voice.
Because everyone knows in this future of people who want to chuck each other outside of space buses to be burned to death in 6 seconds, nobody could possibly speak French.
No. Well, we know from Star Trek The Next Generation that French people in the future speak English.
Yeah.
Except to their dogs, apparently.
Well, we all know the doctor wouldn't be in the same train with someone who's French. We all saw Twice Upon a Time. He hates French people, apparently. So,
oh God,
sorry.
Why on earth would you give that line to the doctor when there is a British soldier from 1913 who probably thinks that standing right there? Yeah.
And yes. Not to mention the first doctor's favorite historical place is the French Revolution.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes,
but he didn't like their kitchen.
He has to draw a line somewhere.
Get me out of this place. It's full of restaurants.
I don't think we're doing an episode on that because I don't think it ever happened.
It didn't.
No.
We talked earlier about how the Doctor turned all the technology off and forced everyone to talk, but I feel like David Tennant's Doctor, the reason why the audience loved him so much was because that he would get along with anyone, despite who they were or anything. He would always start a conversation with everybody, and he seemed like, oh, he's your busy mate, whereas, you know, someone like Peter Capaldi, who I love, a lot of people are like, oh, but he wouldn't even give me a hug. Why would I want to hang out with this guy? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm imagining now Peter Capaldi shutting off that entertainment system, and then when someone tries to start a conversation, no, I wanted silence. Thank you. But no, you're right. David Tennant, yeah, he kind of does that for selfish reasons. But when he says, I want to talk to you all, it's genuinely, I'm not here with Donna. New people. Hi.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who do you think is his favorite on the bus, Josh?
Jethro, because he's my favorite. And you can't go wrong with a goth boy. What can I say?
He's so pretty.
quite right, too. I mean, that's the thing. I usually go for bigger and junkier, but there is something about him.
There is, isn't there?
There is something about
him. He's just such a good actor.
Yeah.
That must be it. Must be it.
He's actually a really good actor as well. Yeah. You know, but especially that bit of, you know, the bus is broken down in the middle of nowhere. Yeah.
Or when he does sort of 666 and, you know, like he gets some sky to repeat it. Like he's being sort of scary and gothy and stuff. He's
kind of meta. Yeah.
I actually get the impression during that whole sequence where the Doctor wants to chat to everyone on the bus, it's like he's auditioning for who his companion is going to be this week. Mm. So, you know, we've got Dee Dee, who is brilliantly intelligent, but sort of a bit trodden on and can only express her intelligence when she's away from the professor. We've got Jethro, who is jokey and says inappropriate things like 666, but is also incredibly intelligent. And we've got Sky, who has the traditional Doctor Who tragic backstory trademark, you know.
But the two of them really hit it off. Like, I think they properly hit it off. And we talked about the moment where, you know, she sees him disable the thing. Mm. I like that little scene.
But it's also that, and that's, again, you know, she is being set up and coded as, this is your companion figure for the week. And then, you know, she's the one that
he hits it off with.
She's the one that he hits it off with. She
is endangered and he rushes straight to help her.
And she has a sympathetic backstory that makes you care about her. And then she's horribly murdered. Like by this bizarre alien creature, and it's just horrible. It's so horrible. I love this story, but it's so horrible.
Listener, that's all we have time for this week. We'll be back next week in a terrifyingly familiar parallel universe to find out what happens when you don't turn left. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bondfinger and Jodie into Terror. Josh, where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me on YouTube just as Josh Snares for more Doctor Who oddity boring stuff.
It's absolutely not boring at all. It's really quite extraordinary. So make sure you check it out. It's definitely worth a look. Until next time, when you go to the market this week, why not sling the Goblin Men a few bob? Their fruits are syrupy and delicious and redolent with erotic subtext. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones, James Selwood and Josh Snares. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg, closing joke by Douglas Adams. This episode, Your Bezzy Mate, was recorded on the 13th of February 2020 and released on the 17th of May. Information about package holidays on Midnight can be found in the leaflet Sun, Sapphires and Suffering on the most totally evil place in the galaxy.
Val wants to see a manager, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
She should have been called Karen.
Yes. Val Karen. Is short for Karen. Caval. No, that's a Blake Seven name. Never mind. Yeah.
Carvin?
Carvin?
Corvin. Carvin.
Creed of the Crummon.
Oh, God. Oh, no, don't say that. We've had Conrad finish. On the podcast.
And he's delightful.
He's gorgeous.
This is all going in.
It really isn't. Let's talk about maybe the most impressive thing in the episode, and that is the interplay between David Tennant and Leslie Sharp.
You were about to say Dunlop, weren't you?
I was. Yeah.
I'll never tire of that.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
When yes. are we doing the Happiness Patrol podcast?
We've done it like 12 times.
Right after Casino Royale. No, it is just stunning.